Hey everyone, check out this new film on Amazon Prime called Eight Remains. It's free to all Prime members. Hey, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Interview. Today we have a fabulous writer all the way from Texas who claims it's only 38 degrees Fahrenheit, but he's not up here where it's below 32 degrees Fahrenheit, so we'll discuss it during the show. John Hughes, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, man. Happy to be here.
So do you get in trouble? Everybody thinks you're like the old John Hughes?
Yes and no. So when I finished the script, I went to go register it with the Writers Guild of America and got a very lovely email back from them that was very understanding of, hey, your paperwork's being held up because you can't register an original script by John Hughes. It never even occurred to me. So I was messaging with them and they were like, well, just use your mom's maiden name. That's what a lot of people do. And my mom's maiden name is Lovitz.
Ah!
And John Lovitz is also a person. I do not want to be taking credit for being, but luckily we had different middle names. So John Patrick Hughes it is.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, I've definitely heard the joke many, many times.
And you've gotten the John Lovitz joke too?
No. That was just something that I realized when they suggested use your mom's maiden name because I hadn't thought about it and then realized I would still be doing kind of the same thing.
Oh, that's weird. So let's start off with the name of the film. It's Camino.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you have a car in mind ahead of time or did the car come in afterwards?
So the car was there from the beginning when I was writing the screenplay. As you know, like in the movie, these two sort of underage slackers steal a cooler and get it home and find that they did not steal what they thought they were stealing. They were looking for beer and instead found a couple of kidneys being illegally trafficked across Texas. So I knew I needed something for them to get away in that was the kind of thing that was so recognizable. Even if you saw one for a second, you would know what it was. So that when the criminals, you know, the people they steal the cooler from come out, you know, if it was in like a coupe, you know, like a four-door car, or like if it was in a Camry or a Ford Taurus, you wouldn't be able to see the cooler was in it. And if it was just in some random truck, well, it's like, well, it could be a Chevy, that could have been a Silverado or a Sierra or anything. But in El Camino was this perfect middle ground of, it's the only car truck anyone ever has seen in their life. It has a bed, so you could see the cooler was in it. And it's so recognizable, you would know that's what you saw. So even if you just saw one whip around the corner, you'd be like, someone in an El Camino just stole my cooler. And so it just sort of checked all the boxes that I needed. And then there it was.
So who owns the Camino? Did you own the Camino?
I owned the Camino, yeah. It also seemed like a good excuse to buy an El Camino. luckily for me, my dad is in the car business, and he reached out to a bunch of friends, and found a car dealer up in Arkansas who had just traded in for one, and we bought it and went and picked it up and drove it down to Texas. And we actually ended up buying two. And so we had a couple come through because I think my dad just got kind of like an itchy trigger finger. He thought it was fun and just bought himself one also. So we had two of them riding around town.
Are they still around?
No, they have since gone. He sold his probably 6 months after the movie Principal Photography was finished. And I sold mine about 2 years afterward when I realized like, it's just not worth having two cars. Especially if you've ever driven an El Camino, they're like 25 feet long. You can't turn them. It's like driving a boat. And when you live in Houston, Texas, like you can't park one anywhere. And they get like 9 gallons to the mile. It's like the least fuel efficient thing you've ever driven. So I sold it and did the responsible thing and put the money towards more valuable stuff.
More movies, I hope.
Hopefully, we'll see.
Whose house did you use off the beginning of the film?
Whose house did I use?
Yeah, who's your film? He's in a bedroom. He puts on a record.
Oh, right. That was actually just an apartment.
Okay.
That we rented for the month. Of Principal Photography, luckily we found an apartment complex that was willing to let us rent one for just a month so that we could use that as our cover set in case it rained. We could always go inside of the apartment and shoot.
Oh.
And we certainly needed that because you've seen the movie.
I have.
It all takes place in a day, and yeah. There's no rain in it.
Nope.
And it rained nonstop the first 14 days we were shooting.
And that's Texas. It shouldn't rain in Texas.
Nonstop. We actually, one of the days we were, when we were shooting out at the driving range location, we actually had a thunderstorm start rolling in, and everyone's phones started blowing up. And it was like, oh, there's a tornado watch. Oh, there's a tornado warning. Oh, there's a tornado. So our tents that we had that were protecting all the equipment literally got blown off into nowhere. We couldn't keep them weighted down. So that turned into a bunch of 25-year-old guys and gals grabbing all this equipment in the pouring rain, trying to run it into this little one-bedroom house that's the only thing on that land, taking our shirts off to try to dry out our lights and cameras so they don't all just die, because Lord knows we didn't have the money for that. And then sitting in a little tiny room, real sad, for like 8 hours. We had ordered pizza, but the guy who went to go get the pizzas couldn't get back in because the roads had flooded out.
Oh.
And we were just stranded in the middle of a tornado. And that was a good day.
Wow. That's a good story, though.
Yeah. We found one of our tents. We didn't find the other one, but one of them we found about 600 feet away in a pond. It looked like a Coke can someone had crunched and just tossed.
So
that's independent filmmaking.
Yes. When you rented the apartment, was it furnished or not furnished?
No, it wasn't furnished. It was a completely just empty apartment. We had an art director for the beginning of the film. They actually ended up leaving the project in the middle of it, which was yet another yay indie filmmaking. They just stopped coming. And then we finally got a hold of them, and they were like, oh, yeah, I'm not doing that anymore. And we're like, oh, well, that's good to know, I guess, in the middle of doing it. But no, so we had to dress the apartment and all that.
So where'd you find a record player?
Oh, I had a record player.
Who has record players?
Me.
I have no idea who I'd find a record player. I probably could find one, but I don't really want one to have. It's okay.
I've got one lying around here. It's sitting in the corner of this very office as we speak. It's right over there.
So when you're writing the script, you have two leads, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you cast them? Because, I mean, I think they have to have a certain look for your film.
Yeah, so... one of the things you might not know about this movie is Justin Herring, my film partner, who I make movies with, is one of my best friends. We actually made this movie in between semesters of college. We were still in school. And so we made it during the summer, in between like the fall and or spring and fall semester. And so, because we were both in film school at the time and really wanted to make a movie while we had access to some stuff that we wouldn't have once we graduated. And so Cody Michael Davids, who plays Jack, who is the kid who actually has the El Camino, he was a friend of ours in the theater department, who had been in all of Justin's short films, and he was just a buddy. And then we did a really big casting call for just like video auditions for both Mark and Jack, and narrowed it down to about 10 of each.
Oh,
and
wow.
Had them both come down to East Texas, at the little Nacogdoches, Texas, which is a town of like 25,000 in the middle of nowhere, and just teamed them up in different pairings and had them read scenes. And like every Mark read with every Jack. Most of the Jacks and Marks, we flipped them. You know, like you read it as a Mark now, you read as Jack. Because it was really important to me and Justin, you know, to not go like, oh, this guy had a great audition as Mark, we'll cast him. This guy's a great Jack, we'll cast him. Because they're never really alone in the movie.
Nope.
We knew it was all about who's the best duo, even if that's the third best Mark and the fifth best Jack, but they seem the most like real friends. Well, then that's the guys we want. So we just did that for a few hours one day and landed Matthew James, who plays Mark in the movie, once him and Cody teamed up and read as Mark and Jack, we were like, oh, those are our guys. They just seem like they've been friends and they don't even know each other, but there's something about it. And so, yeah, that's how we went with that.
Does every town have a Trevor?
Every town has a Trevor. Every town has a Trevor. That was one of the more universal things I think we had when we were doing our film festival circuit and just showing the movie. I mean, we couldn't have shown the movie in more places that or places that were more different than East Texas. And all the time, every screening, there was someone who was like, oh, we totally had that shitty friend who's really a nice guy. Like, he's not a bad person, but he's just kind of worthless. And you ask him to do a few things, and he kind of never came through, but you can't really stay mad at him because he's not trying to hurt anybody. He's just kind of around. You know, everyone's got a Trevor in their life. And, yeah.
So I want to discuss the character of Becky now.
Okay.
And before we get there, I want to discuss her place of work.
Yes.
Where's her place of work? Because I think it needs something. And did they let you shoot there no problem? Or because it looked like there was customers in there while the scene was going on.
Yeah, so her place of work in the movie is a Greek restaurant called Avo's, which is actually a Greek restaurant in Nacogdoches, Texas, called Pepper Jack's, where it's like Greek food and a build-your-own burrito place. So it's kind of like – it started as a me and Justin became very good friends with the owner. He's Greek, but he knew if he opened a Greek restaurant in East Texas, he was afraid no one would come.
Yeah, I would think that.
So he opened like a Chipotle-style build-your-own burrito place that also happened to have a Greek menu where they're like, you can order a falafel plate or some shawarma or a gyro. And after a couple of years, he actually ended up, right after we finished the movie, opening exclusively a Greek restaurant next door to it because the Greek menu got so popular. But yeah, that place, Justin and I probably ate there 500 times through our college education.
Oh, my God.
And because it was like 100 yards from my house and the film department, it was like right in the middle. So me and Justin just met there for lunch probably every other day. And, yeah, Avo, the owner, came up to us one day while we were eating and was like, I heard you guys are making a movie. And we were like, yeah. He's like, do you need a restaurant? And we said, actually, we kind of do. And he's like, well, you know, I'm closed on Sundays. Y'all have been here enough times. He's like, I'll just leave you the keys. So we said, thanks. And he did. He left us the keys. So we got, you know, some hats and shirts mocked up that said Avo's and named the fake restaurant after him. But yeah, he just let us take it over for a Sunday and that was it. Yeah.
So let's get into the character of Becky a bit, because I think it's important we talk about Becky.
Let's talk about Becky, sure.
Is Becky based on anybody you know?
So Becky is like an amalgamation, right? She's like this sort of collective of not real people, if that makes sense. So it's one of the things that when we were writing about this was like we knew we needed a part of this sort of like B storyline. Something else needed to be going on for us to sort of move in between enough things to keep the pace going, but not just drag ourselves down with one story the whole time. And it just sort of came to me one day of like, you always hear when you're a guy in high school or right out of high school, you always hear about your buddy's girlfriend and you only hear the worst stuff about her because you're only ever hearing his side of the story. And you're always just like, yeah, man, my buddy Ted's girlfriend sucks. Like she's always screaming at him on the phone and like, he's always in trouble. But you never hear the part where Ted's like, oh, yeah, I did 50 stupid things because I'm an 18-year-old boy, and that's why she's so mad at me. And so that was what we decided to do with Becky was, like, Becky should just be the angry girlfriend on the phone that Jack is like, oh, she's the worst. She's terrible. But Becky, if you made another movie of Camino that was from Becky's perspective, it would be about a girl who thinks she's pregnant and the one nice guy she likes won't answer the phone and won't talk to her and just keeps hanging up on her and is being super unhelpful because he happens to have this whole thing going on with stolen kidneys, but she doesn't know that and he doesn't know that. And yeah, so that was kind of like the initial nugget of Becky. And also Becky is another character that a lot of people have been like, I knew a girl like that in high school who was just the meanest human being I have ever met. And I could never figure out why, you know, and some people, I don't know.
Did you enjoy writing Becky's dialogue? Cause she seems to be most fun to write.
Yes and no. One of the interesting things about a lot of Becky's dialogue is because at times it was really important for us because Becky does a lot of, she has a lot of sort of strown out monologue, freak out, screamy, yelly sort of moments, which for actors, those can be really hard to memorize when you're trying to get that much energy up to be that specific with your words. Though Bonnie Gale, who plays Becky, was amazing. And she's like the nicest human being I've ever met, which lets you know she's a really good actress because she's terrifying in the movie.
Yep.
But no, a lot of her dialogue it would just sort of, I would just write into the script something to the effect of, like, Becky leaves the apartment mumbling obscenities, and just leave it as something like that. That way on set, we could be like, just say whatever you want. You don't have, don't get in your head, just walk out the door, call him every word you can think of. So I think Bonnie got to have a lot of fun with that aspect of the Becky stuff, because we really did just sort of let her off the hook. And she said some stuff that I had never dreamed of. So, yeah, I think she had a good time with it for sure. There was certainly, going back to casting, there was a really funny casting day, which was the callbacks for Becky, because all of the sides, you know, that you have for them to audition with are really just her screaming at someone.
Yeah.
She's kind of angry the whole time. And I couldn't be there that day, so Justin filmed all of the callbacks and showed them to me when we got back. And Justin had to read all of the mark parts, so I just got a Dropbox. Like, he emailed me a link, like, of 30 minutes of just different girls just screaming at Justin, and it always ended with the most meek and kind of terrified, like, thank you so much for coming in. That was great. You know, and you could tell he was mortified by the end of the day because there were just people screaming at him. And that was really fun for me. I don't know if he had a lot of fun with that, but that was a good day.
What is the Pines Theater like? It looks nice.
The Pines Theater is great. So that is in Lufkin, Texas, which is my hometown, where we shot about half of the movie. It's like a 50-50 split between there and Nacogdoches, which is where Justin and I went to film school. But they're neighboring towns. Like, they touch each other, so it's really easy to get to. But the Pines is just an old theater in downtown Lufkin that the city bought and recently renovated. We actually had our first test screening there, where we invited a lot of people from the community. Like, hey, it's a free movie. Just come watch. We'll do a little Q&A after, give y'all some cards to fill out and give us your thoughts while we're still editing the film. But it's a beautiful theater. It's only one screen, you know, but it's got a full balcony upstairs and all the original work is still in it. And it's really pretty gorgeous.
So I have to ask you about your cards. Why did you write on the cards? Why did you ask them? Because these may be people that don't normally go to a film or would know how to edit a film or even know what they're looking for.
Yeah, so we wanted to keep it kind of simple, but mostly we wanted to keep it to simple questions that would answer questions we ourselves had about the film, such as, like, one of the questions was, like, who's your least favorite character? And that was something we were like, hopefully everyone answers Becky, because then that means we actually did Becky right, because you're not really supposed to like Becky as a person when you're watching the movie. So maybe that, like, you know, especially in, like, a small town in East Texas where, like, people off the street should be like, I'm not a huge fan, you know, and then just very boilerplate stuff. Like, was there any scene that was confusing? Was there any part of the movie that felt too long? Was there any, you know, anything? Was there any time in the movie where you checked your phone? I think was a question, because that was the kind of thing of, like, if they're checking their phone, well, then maybe that section, about it's dragging. It's going too slow. And, yeah, we mostly got back really positive stuff. That was an interesting experience. We'd never really done that before. And then we did a few smaller ones after that with, like, groups of friends who we would just have come and screen the movie for them and work it down from there.
See, I would argue Becky is not, but Becky's my favorite character.
Yeah? There have been some people who've said that. Who's your least favorite character?
I'm going to tell you now, because I figured you're going to ask me. My least favorite character is probably the golf guy. He really doesn't do anything.
Uncle Alvin,
he's kind of placid for me. But, I mean,
okay.
That's just because he doesn't have a lot to do. It's all right, just like him. He just doesn't do anything.
I gotcha. Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that was interesting from, like, a writing perspective. That was very intentional, because we knew going into it would make the movie more shootable, which was important because we didn't have a lot of money and we didn't have a ton of time. Was the aspect of the movie that, like, it's all going to take place in one day. This story will start in the morning and it will end at night. We will get through this in a day, which really freed us up with certain characters like an Uncle Alvin, because we did have some people at Q&As all over the country go, well, what's up with Uncle Alvin? Like, does he know the cop when she comes later? Because it seems like they've met before. Like, what's their past or something like that? And you're just like, that's the upside and the downside of the whole movie in a day thing is like, you will never know what happens before this. You're not going to get to know what happens after. This is about today.
Well, I think they dated. So, I think that was pretty evident.
Oh, they knew each other. They had to. It's a small town.
Yeah, like they know each other. There's some hook up there between some. But, I mean, that's a small town. I expected that. Let's go back to the small town. You have, your police force has a definite feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have one smart cop and two maybe not so smart cops.
Yeah.
Was that a definite plan?
The cops changed a lot. So we cast the cops same way with the two leads. Like we called in all the possible cops and just mixed them up in order and ended up with the group we have, which was two women and one man. And so I had to actually go back. There's a joke that the one lady officer, female officer, is named Carla, but she says, call me Carl.
Because
in the script, name was Carl. And I was like, well, if we put a joke, like if I write a joke in before that, that she sort of idolizes this cop that she calls Maxie and she goes, call me Max.
Yeah.
And then repeats it to the next guy. Well, then I don't have to change Carl the rest of the way through the script. That saves me a lot of time. And so we got to have a female officer named Carl, but it still makes sense. But yeah, that was sort of always in there. Particularly, the only thing that really changed was once we realized we were going to have two female cops for sure, once we had cast them. And we kind of realized that there was sort of a fun dynamic to have the lieutenant, Maxine, and to have Carla, also known as Carl, have someone directly to look up to. Like the lieutenant on this police force is also a woman. And so she kind of mimics her behavior throughout the movie and kind of looks up to her. And then we have Rich, who's just as straightforward, kind of fun, dope, slapstick bits as you can get. Which was actually our friend Trey Cartwright, who is just a friend of ours from film school. He wanted to do it, so.
Because you even go back to that joke later in the film. She goes, yeah, her name is Carla, but she's friend Carl. You even put that at the end to re-emphasize what's going on. I did catch that. Now, when you have the two friends sitting beside each other at a table, who does that? Two slackers?
Yeah, well, there's an explanation, right?
There is. I'm going to let it go, but I'm like, really?
Yeah, well, that was one of those things. When you watch movies, that happens all the time.
I know.
People talking at a diner or talking in a booth. People sit on the same side. It's easier to shoot that way.
I was going to ask that. That's my next question. I go, yeah, it's probably just easier to shoot that.
It's easier to shoot, but as we were doing it, and when you see it when the scene starts – Jack actually sits on the opposite side and then gets up and goes to the other side of the table to sit next to him. And yeah, essentially he goes, why are you sitting on this side? There are two sides. And he goes, well, you bitch about sitting. I like to prop my feet up.
Yep.
And he's like, well, you can prop your feet up from the other side. He goes, yeah, but when I do that, you bitch about eating next to my feet. He's like, well, we're not eating. It just becomes this whole thing. But yeah, we knew for shooting that was going to be the way it had to go well before we ever got on set. So it just seemed like something that you could solve in the script of like, let's at least have fun, make a moment out of this, give ourselves a reason to put him on this side of the table because there's no reason not to. It would just seem lazy to have them appear that way. So, yeah, we wrote something in.
So it sounds like you actually learned something in film school.
A little bit. We went to a very small film school. We went to Stephen F. Austin State University, which is a very little school you've probably never heard of. That film department is just like the rest of the school, very small, but does, because of that, have one thing kind of going for it, which is it puts the onus on the education on the students pretty early. So if you want to check, there's a room full of equipment. Whenever you want it, it's yours. It's very hands-on. Go crazy. Go make as many mistakes as you want. And so that is something, particularly with shooting a film and knowing how in the writing process you can start editing in your head because you start imagining how you're going to have to shoot it. You do get a great education in that because you just get out in the world enough times with the camera and go, oh, when I tried it this way, I screwed up and it didn't work. So I know I've got to do it this way well before I ever get there. And that was something that both Justin and I did a lot in film school. We were very hands-on. I know Justin also did graduate school, and I think one time we talked about it, he'd probably worked on like 65 short films by the time he graduated, which for some people is a career's worth of work.
Yeah.
I mean, like, yeah, I was in film school for 3 years Because, you know, your freshman year, you're not really doing anything. You're just kind of covering your basics. I was in film school for 3 years and probably worked on 35 short films and got a good, really good education out of it. Got a lot of really practical use. Like, we're very good at being on a film set, and that's something that is valuable because a lot of times in film school, you're learning, you're spending a lot of time with theory, and everyone wants to be a director, and everyone's working on how they're going to become a director. And then you get out of film school and you go into the real world, and the first job you're going to get is being a grip or a PA or an electric or an assistant camera operator. You're going to have to work your way up. And if you've never done any of these jobs, you're going to get out of the local film community loop pretty fast, because people are going to go, that guy didn't know how to do anything. Sits around a lot. They're not hands on. They're not very helpful. I don't need that person around. And so coming out of SFA or Stephen F. Austin, that was something that's not a problem. You're going to be on set. There's a lot of favor trading and you learn a lot, you know, since I need an actor. And Becky told me that she would edit my project because I'm editing Steve's. You know, you're just doing all these favors and that helps you sort of build this network of filmmakers. You learn how to work with one another pretty early. And yeah, so that was definitely something that helped a lot while we were in film school. Before going into actually shooting this movie and trying to make it, we were pretty well versed in, we were well versed in knowing what we could do. Like, we knew our limitations. We knew how far we could push something and it work and how far we could push something and it not work. And so that was very helpful from Jump Street, I think, in getting the movie done.
So this is your first feature that I know of. Maybe it's not. Mm-hmm. How'd you get the funds for your film? Did you crowdfund it? Did you ask family and friends?
Yeah, so we did a Kickstarter for trying to get $10,000. That was our start. And we actually ended up raising about $11,000. And in the process of doing that, a guy from my hometown reached out to me, who's a wealthier guy, owns a lot of buildings around town. And he was like, hey, I see you're trying to make a movie in Lufkin, Texas. I think that's really cool. He's like, I'd like to help. So he pitched in more money, as well as all of his locations. He's like, I own all these buildings. You can shoot in any building I own if you need to. Which led to stuff like in the opening sort of title montage, when Jack and Mark are driving around looking for beer, Jack ends up on a construction site and a guy smashes a hammer through a wall.
Yes.
That was an apartment or an old hotel that our investor was renovating. And he was like, if you guys need to smash any walls, he's like, go tear them out. He's like, I'm having them torn out anyway. So, like, we added that into that little montage. Oh, he should check out a construction site because that's just fun. We'll get a chance to go break something without getting in any trouble. And then outside of that, Justin and I just put in all the money we had. And the total budget of the movie, it's under $30,000. It's not a lot of money at all.
So I want to discuss one of the main characters, not main, I guess subplot maybe, the man telling the guy, Gary, the story that makes no sense, that he changes it, about the $20, the purse stealing.
Oh, yeah, the older, in the script, he's just called Old. He's the older criminal, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Did that something you just create, or is that a story you actually heard?
That's just something we made up. That was just something that was written in there. It's kind of this... Again, sort of like cinematic story plot device of once we've heard him do it once, if he starts to go into it again, the audience is going to know ahead of time, like, oh, Trevor's in trouble. Like, this speech is not a speech that goes well. And when we see that he alters it, you realize that this is just something he says to try to get the reaction he feels he needs at the time. Because when he does it with Trevor, we really feel like he's trying to give Trevor an out.
Yeah.
But as we know, Trevor didn't take his car to the gas station because that's not his car in the garage. Trevor's just not understanding what's going on in this situation. And then, of course, he even tries it again at the very end. And the younger of the two criminals, who in the screenplay is just referred to as Youngin, even splurts out, like, we don't have any time for stories, because you can't imagine how many times he's probably heard this exact same scenario go on. But yeah, that was just something that felt like it offered us the opportunity to set up that criminal. The older criminal is sort of like a criminal with a set of ethics. Like, he does have some morals that he's like, we wanted people to have the thought that had the fight at the gas station never happened, they'd have just moseyed through town. He'd have never bothered anyone. It was only because his job got disrupted that he was sort of forced to do these things that he otherwise would never have done. The younger, more hot-headed criminal, you do get the feeling you're like, well, that guy's kind of a loose cannon and just generally sort of dangerous and maybe shouldn't be around anyone. So we wanted to sort of set up that even within the group of the criminals, there was conflict there. Like, everybody sort of has something going on. It was something that Justin and I said a lot throughout the pre-production stage, was that every character in this movie should be having the worst day of their life. Like, no one is having a good time. But hopefully the audience will enjoy all of that, if that makes sense.
I'm going to jump my next question. We'll go back to it. Pearl.
Yeah.
How is Pearl having a bad day? Just that these two clowns are bugging her?
Well, I guess maybe Pearl's not having a bad day. Pearl is just kind of a grumpy old gal. And Pearl was really the kind of thing that is sort of this character that's placed into the movie to help give an audience an idea of what kind of town this is. You know, just sort of help further cement that. Like, this is a town that is stuck many decades in the past, and a lot of people, the way they talk and their opinions of the world and certain things. And so that was just a way to help hammer that home. It's like, this is a very small town in, you know, deep East Texas, where the country has not maybe caught up to what other people think it should be. In other cities like Houston, Austin, San Francisco, New York, wherever. But yeah, so that was that. And Jodi Ryan, who plays Pearl, is a local actress to Nacogdoches who does a lot of community theater and just wanted to come down.
I could see that. I definitely knew she was an actress. She had it down. She knew her part. It was good. Yeah.
She brought her own wardrobe. She had her own nurses, like, get up and everything. She was like, I'll bring my own hat and the whole nine yards, and just showed up with it.
Perfect.
So we were like, all right, great.
Thank you. Now, the gas station location.
Mm-hmm.
Gas station tacos. Does this exist?
100%.
You're kidding me.
No.
So you go into your gas station in this town, I get a taco?
All the time. Yeah.
Okay. Do they taste good?
Oh, they're the best. It's all throughout Texas, particularly South Texas. It's very common. You can go into a gas station and, like, there will essentially be, like, a second counter set up inside the gas station where a local Mexican family has sort of leased out that corner with a little bit of – and put it in a small kitchen, and they just make tacos and sell it out of there. And they're amazing, and they're always the loveliest people, and it's great. And, yeah, you can fill up your truck and go inside and get, like, three, like, lovely handmade pastor tacos where they're, like, pressing tortillas in the back and get on your way. It's great. It's the best.
How did you get the gas station location?
Gas station was a location that Justin had shot at for a previous short film, and they are closed inside at night, so they let us shoot all night. So everything you're seeing in the gas station is a night shot.
Didn't look like one. It was very well lit. Good work, guys.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll no, we were that was a lot of that. Logistics of that, but everything that happens in there is like 4 a.m.
So I have a couple of other things. The toothbrush is in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
How many toothbrushes does one person need?
Well, so the bit there with the toothbrushes really is something that's supposed to pay. Again, it's like a little bit of a something to give you, because we're only going to be here with these guys for a day, to sort of inform you to, like, their life choices. So, you know, like, when they're coming out of the apartment, Jack says to Mark, like, have you ever counted how many toothbrushes you have in the apartment?
Yeah.
You make that many mistakes, one of them's bound to end up pregnant. And it's just a little line that's enough of an insight to give the audience the notion of, like, these are all the girls who have stayed over with Mark who go, oh, I didn't have a toothbrush.
Oh.
And you go and get one at the gas station. And there's probably 50 of them in there.
I didn't get that. Okay, thanks for explaining that. Totally went over my head, that one.
Yeah, no, so it's one line that if you get it, because later Jack's like, you can thank me by throwing them away. And he's like, well, I can't do that. Cause what if they come back and see that I got rid of theirs? They think I didn't care about them anymore. And you realize that, like, Mark is a very sentimental guy. He's just also a young kind of idiot. And at the end of the movie, he finally actually throws them away.
He does.
which gives you a little bit of a semblance that, like, maybe he's growing up because, you know, Becky might in fact be pregnant, and there, you know, maybe he's actually going to take these steps to, like, change his life a little bit. Because we all know a guy like a Mark who thinks that his Jack in his life is the one kind of holding him back. He's like, well, I've got my stuff together, and Jack's kind of the idiot, but doesn't ever take the time to be accountable of, like, you still choose to spend all day with him. Like, that's what you do. You're not doing anything. And that's something, I mean, I can speak for myself. A lot of people realize, like, throughout their, like, late teenagers, your early mid-20s, there's a lot of accountability that sort of comes up to where you're like, oh, yeah, when I sit around with my idiot friends and go, God, these guys are a bunch of idiots, like, I'm also sitting there. You know, like, I also sat there for 5 hours and talked about nothing. Whether or not I thought I had more going on than them, clearly I didn't. You know, we were all in this together.
True, true.
So, yeah, that is the toothbrushes.
There we go. See, thanks for breaking that down for me.
Yeah, no problem.
The two partners, the two criminal partners,
mm-hmm.
How could they possibly work together? This must be their first job.
Yeah, there's, again, one of the many lovely benefits of this all takes place in a day is it is what it is.
Yeah, I agree. I couldn't see them working together more than one job, though.
Well, they don't. Spoiler alert, they might not make it all the way to
this. I was good. I'm not going.
Well, you know, I mean, the movie's out on Amazon Prime. It's free. You can just go stream it, everyone in the world. So you don't have to worry about it coming to theaters. I'm not spoiling anything. Okay. You can't find yourself.
Okay. I want one last location, the hospital location.
Yes.
Is that a real hospital where you shot in, or is it just – I didn't – okay. Explain to me how this works.
Okay. Happy to. The exterior is an exterior shot of a hospital, I think, in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
That's actually something that we got from someone else because our local hospital wouldn't let us show the exterior of the hospital because it is branded and they didn't want to be associated with the movie at all. So it's a hospital in Chicago for the exterior. Then there is the sliding glass, you know, the automatic glass doors at the front where the car is parked. That is the actual local hospital in Lufkin because you can't see any name or anything, so they didn't care. The hallway and front desk where Pearl is actually the back room of a local church that looks exactly like a hospital.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Absolutely.
And then the hospital room is from the nursing school at our university. It's their practice room for when kids are going through their stuff. So it's actually four locations that when jammed together are very much a convincing hospital, but that did not require the insanely expensive insurance it takes to actually go shoot in a hospital.
Well, there you go. See, I had to ask you because it looked like a real hospital to me, but I'm like, there's no way this is. I'm going to have to ask how it works.
No, I'm very happy to talk about that sort of stuff too because that's the sort of stuff that, like, if you're watching a movie, like a little independent film, and you want to make one, you go, God, they must have had a ton of money. It's so hard to make a movie. And it's really not. You just need to be willing to go the extra mile. Like, go to four locations to make your one location, and it goes from $150,000 a day to free. It costs you nothing. And, like, all of these things are attainable. So if you're out there and you're wanting to make a movie, like, just, like, take two steps to the left and look at the thing again, you know, and realize that, like, the audience will only know what you show them.
Yeah.
So if I show them a back hallway in a church and I tell them it's a hospital, it's a hospital, you know?
I agree. So, one last thing, since you're an indie production, very small, I have to ask mm-hmm. about catering.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you feed your crew and yourself?
So again, another one of those just things that worked out for us by being in a small town. The university that we went to has a hospitality program. And in the summers, for summer one, they do a bulk cooking course for catering events. So we made a donation to the hospitality department. And in exchange, when they finished cooking every day at one, they would deliver the food to wherever we were on set.
That's awesome.
So we had a four-course catered meal every day that was always different. Like, they sent us the menu like a week in advance because they were always so excited about getting to help out with the movie and drove it to us on set. And we ate it every day. It was wonderful. Catering was excellent.
That's a pretty cool story. I like that one.
Yeah. That was easy.
Okay, now it's time for fun questions.
All right.
And I know you've done a lot of prepping for these.
I've done none because you told me I wasn't allowed to have any.
Favorite film?
Oh, that's a tough one. So I'll probably go favorite film. I tend to answer this with like the movie I've seen the most times, because that's probably my favorite film.
Not mine,
you know, if I'm being honest. So that would be The Invisible Man, like the old James Whale, The Invisible
Great
Man.
Great film. Absolutely phenomenal film.
I love that movie so much. My dad got me like the VHS Universal Monsters box set when I was like 6 or 7 years old, and I wore that thing out. Claude Rains.
That's a fabulous film. Absolutely fabulous.
Beautiful. Great movie.
Your favorite city?
Houston, Texas.
Why?
I grew up about 2 hours north of here. I live here now. But when I was growing up in East Texas, the nearest big city was Houston. So I associated Houston with like the once a summer trip my family would make to like the Astrodome to watch a baseball game or to get to come into the city and like, you know, see the Rockets play. And I just love it here. It's very hot. It's very humid. It's kind of a secret swamp city built on the coast. But I love it because we're all sweating together. You know, it's a great community. It's one of the kind of places where if you're willing to drive 20 minutes, you can get a world-class anything. I just love it. It's my favorite city in the world.
And you may have hockey soon, which will make me happy.
I hope we get hockey soon, man.
It's coming.
Tillman Fertitta said once he bought the Rockets, he's like, I don't want to share this, spend this lease entirely by myself here at the Toyota Center. I think we're gonna get a hockey team.
It's coming.
We used to have the Houston Aeros.
Oh God, that's like 70s. 80s?
No, they went away in like 2002.
Yeah,
I think.
Didn't they play in the WHA for a long time?
Then they were the Minnesota Wilds, like
yes, farm team.
That's prospects the, farm team.
Yeah, so they're in, yeah.
Yeah. AHL. I love the Houston Aeros were great because you could get like glass seats for like $35.
Oh, yeah.
That was awesome. Loved the Aeros. I hope Houston hockey needs to come back. I'm sure none of your listeners care about this, but
I do.
Houston hockey needs to come back.
I do. Give me a reason to get there. And the last one's the easiest one. Your favorite food?
Oh, gyozas. Or pot stickers.
Oh, okay. I don't know.
Yeah,
pot stickers.
Any sort of Asian dumpling. I will make a scene out of myself if they are like I'll eat 150 of them and not realize I did it. I'll ruin any diet I could possibly be on. I love them.
So is that your record for most dumplings eating in one sitting? Is 150?
No. I don't know what it actually is. It's probably, if I'm being honest, it's probably in the 40s, which is still shameful. Like, it's a lot of dumplings.
Oh, it's so good. I could eat 40, no problem.
They're great. They are great. But I love those. One could argue whether or not they're, like, a meal necessarily, but I love them. If I had to go, like, a second and third, I shift very quickly into stereotypical Texan, and it's, like, brisket and then tacos. Which luckily for me are even available at gas stations here.
I'm going to try a gas station taco now if I ever make it down there.
There is a gas station in Dallas called Fuel City that started a taco stand in the parking lot that became such a big deal that the gas station like franchised. There are multiple Fuel Cities in the state of Texas now, and they all have a taco place built into them because the taco place in Dallas had lines like down the highway of people trying to come eat in the parking lot. And now they're like a franchise. Yeah.
That's awesome. Tell everybody where they can find your film.
Gladly. You can find this movie right now on Amazon. It's Amazon Prime. It's $9.99 to buy, $2.99 you can rent it. It's free to stream if you're a Prime member. I believe we are available for Amazon in America, Canada, the UK, pretty much every English-speaking country that has Amazon Prime access. We're on there. It's free. Just go watch it. We hope you like it. If you leave us a review saying you like it, it means the world to us because we can see it. And, you can find us on Twitter at @Camino_movie. And we're on Facebook, like facebook.com/CaminoMovie. We're on Instagram @CaminoTheMovie. And yeah, just find us. If you search us on Amazon under Prime for movies, we're the first Camino that pops up, I believe. Blue poster, El Camino on it. It's actually a hand painted poster design that an art student did back when we were in school for us that I just thought was the coolest thing on earth. Her name's Kim Rogers. Now she works for the Rockets, actually doing design work, and is an incredible graphic designer. If anyone out there needs somebody, reach out to Kim Rogers. Yeah, that's where you can find us. Find us on Amazon. Find us on Twitter and Instagram. Reach out. We'd love to talk to you.
Thank you so much for your time. You have a great night.
Thanks. You too.
Bye.
Bye, bud.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page? Thank you.